Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. If you have a question for any of our guests today, give us a call. The number is 800-524-3604. That's 800-524-3604. Or send us an email, midday@sdpb.org. Kevin Cole is a professor of English at the University of Sioux Falls, but he also has an appointment in the history program where he teaches African American history. Cole is a poet who pursues a variety of scholarly interests, including American slave narratives. Kevin Cole, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Hi, thanks, Lori. It's great to be here.
You're joining us from Sioux Falls, correct?
I am.
All right, let's start with the obvious question of what exactly constitutes a slave narrative.
Sure. At its most basic, slave narratives are the first-person accounts of American slaves who escaped and lived to tell their stories, and or slaves who recorded their stories after the Civil War. So we refer to two types or two genres of slave narratives, antebellum and postbellum narratives. We think there were about 5 million slaves either brought to the colonies and later the United States into slavery or born into slavery. And there we have about 6,000 known slave narratives. So these are real gems, if you will. Slave narratives are autobiographical, but we don't consider them autobiographies, if only because they're not long enough. Moreover, they don't tend to all of the elements that an autobiography typically attends to. They are memoir-like, but we don't consider them memoirs because they don't present the kind of intense examination of the self, that kind of probing psychological portrait that authors of memoirs present. They have many other intentions. So we call them narratives. And it's a word that itself appears in many of the titles of slave narratives.
So what kind of condition are some of these texts, were they originally found in, and how were they discovered?
Right. Well, pretty much slave narratives were dismissed until the 1930s. They were seen as unreliable. They were seen as unimportant. And this is a result of, as you might expect, racism and elitism. Then in the Roosevelt administration, people in the Works Project administration, specifically the Federal Writers Project, began interviewing former slaves. They recognized that they needed to get these stories. And so that's sort of the beginning. So we have slave narratives that are also recordings. And then a woman named Marion Starling in the 1940s took on slave narratives as a project for her dissertation. And through an incredibly impressive investigation, found about 6,000. Hmm. These can be anything from sheets of paper to pamphlets to books.
So what kind of places was she finding these things? Like, where were they located?
Right. Everywhere. People's attics, garage sales, the Library of Congress, special collections and libraries. I think it took her 6 to 7 years to complete her dissertation because she was always on the run, always investigating. Undoubtedly, there are probably more out there that every once in a while someone by sheer luck will uncover, or someone will be searching in the archives of a special collections library and uncover one.
Was pretty much everything written down after, or was anything sort of written and then smuggled out? As far as I'm thinking, the words actually on the piece of paper, the actual text itself, was that not created until after someone had achieved freedom, or were they writing somehow in the condition that they were in?
Oh, right. I don't know of any that were written when the slave was in a state of slavery. All the ones that I'm familiar with, and I think the vast majority, are written after the slave escapes or written after the Civil War. And that's why we call them antebellum or postbellum narratives.
Are there differences between the text or the context of an antebellum narrative and a postbellum narrative? Do they read differently?
Yes. The differences are absolutely fascinating and really pretty stunning. The antebellum narratives typically do not blanch at the violence and deprivations committed upon slaves. In fact, they emphasize the violence in all of its hideous forms. They emphasize the violence committed on families, namely the unceremonious separation of mothers from children, spouses from spouses. They emphasize the hypocrisy of the United States, both in terms of its claims to be a representative democracy informed by inalienable rights, but also in terms of its cultural identification as a Christian country. This, to me, is perhaps the most intriguing part of antebellum slave narratives, is that as much as they document what slavery does to the slave, they document what slavery does to the slave owner, the slaveholder, which is, to use Lord Acton's words, it corrupts absolutely. And so finally, many of these documents are also very intentional abolitionist documents. Many of the slaves who escape become involved in the abolitionist community. So they're really interesting in that respect. The postbellum narratives are much different. We might best characterize them as rags to respectability narratives. They are typically sort of more spiritual in tone in terms of spiritual autobiographies. They don't emphasize the hypocrisies. They don't have that rhetorical potency driving the narrative. There's far less bitterness, far less anger. It's almost as if they want to forget slavery and forget the past. And the best known of these that I'm guessing many of your listeners are familiar with is Booker T. Washington's Up From Slavery, published in 1901. He mentions slavery in Chapter 1 and then never mentions it again. He wants to talk about the fact that he's a college president, that he keeps company with the captains of industry, and that he's dined with the President of the United States.
So how were these documents used politically then? Are they literary documents? Are they political documents?
Right. Well, certainly the antebellum documents were used politically. So, for example, probably the best known one is Frederick Douglass's Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave, published in 1845. Douglass is friends with the most well-known, the leading abolitionist, William Lloyd Garrison, who's publisher of The Liberator. And it's Garrison who sort of facilitates Douglass's career, both as a writer and as an orator. And they are a fiery abolitionist team. And Douglass's book is as much abolitionist propaganda, and I use that in a neutral sense, that word in neutral sense, as it is a story of his life. It is indeed literary as well. It's an extraordinary literary document. And we shouldn't overlook a book that's now as famous as Douglass, and that is Harriet Jacobs' Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, published in 1861. She wants to document the life of what it is to be a woman slave. She repeatedly asserts in her narrative that being a slave woman is actually much more difficult than being a male slave. And you get two really perspectives in terms of gender with these two narratives as well, and both have very political goals.
So is that a difficult read then, Harriet Jacobs' work?
Yes.
Is it fairly graphic? What kind of impact does it have on the reader?
Right. Editors typically give a warning. Harriet Jacobs herself gives a warning. That said, she's writing in the very polite 19th century, and so there are certain things she won't say directly. There are certain phrases she won't use. She has to couch her language carefully. Her audience is the northern middle class, upper middle class woman who has abolitionist tendencies. But she includes enough information, enough innuendo for you to know what is happening to her, and of course what is happening to most slave women in general.
I'm wondering how you became interested in this topic.
Sure. Well, in my African American history class, I've always included a 2.5-week, 3-week unit on the slave narrative, where we read a slave narrative or two, analyze it, discuss it. Then in the fall of 2014, a colleague of mine showed me an advertisement for a a seminar at Yale on slave narratives. I applied for it, was accepted, and so that was in June of 2015, and I got to study with David Blight, who's a renowned 19th century American historian, Frederick Douglass scholar, scholar of slave narratives, and 25 other like-minded people. And it was a great experience, and it was there I realized that perhaps I could teach a course just devoted to the slave narrative. So when I came home, I put that course together, and so I'd say that seminar really sort of launched me, catapulted me into a different level of interest in slave narratives.
Is there anything in particular or specific that compels you about the slave narrative that makes you want to continue studying it?
Well, yes. I mean, as you say, it sometimes it can weigh down on you, reading day in, day out about the savagery, families torn asunder, sexual assault, outright murder. You have to step away and experience some catharsis. The good news is that I never cease to be amazed by the character and virtues of slaves. They're virtues that we want our children, students, to possess. Optimism, hope, perseverance, resilience, these sorts of things, commitment to one's family. And I guess the will to endure this most heinous fate, I never get tired of that. And the current project I'm working on right now is interesting to me because it's only one of five slave narratives I have found that's been published west of the Mississippi. And this one was published in Omaha in 1906. And so, you know, finding things like this continues to drive me as well.
What kind of responses do you get from your students?
Well, I have to be honest and say that for this interim class, I expected for only 6 to 8 students to register. As it turns out, I have 33. So
wow.
It's really exciting. I'm excited. I have a lot of students from the sciences and social sciences and business. I was expecting mostly humanities students, so that's been great. And it's been wonderful to watch them respond. Honestly, I've never taught this before, so I wasn't sure how they would respond. I was worried that by this time they might be bored out of their minds, but in fact, they're engaged. They come to class having read and prepared. It's been a delight to watch them become experts in the slave narrative, a delight to watch them become more critical, analytical readers with respect to historical documents. And I guess the most rewarding thing is seeing the slave narrative being read, interpreted, and analyzed as a serious, significant document about the American experience. Hmm. And so I've been really pleased with their response, and I'll definitely offer the course again.
Do you get,
based on this class.
Yeah. Do you get hints as you're reading those words where that will to endure came from for the writers of these documents?
You know, it's we these are questions that we pose about the narratives. What keeps a slave going?
Mm-hmm.
After any number of inordinately cruel deprivations committed upon them, what keeps hope and optimism alive? Obviously, many of them lost hope and optimism. If you were a slave in Georgia, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, there essentially was no hope. There's a little more hope for you if you're in the so-called Upper South, Maryland, for example, and there's the opportunity, real opportunities to escape. But I think the things that keep us all going, family and friends, and of course there's always the threat that you're going to lose your family and friends each day. It's this phrase we use, the human spirit, the ability to endure the most impossible circumstances. I don't know where it comes from.
Are your students making those connections then with modern day slavery, modern day war torn communities? Are they making those connections to today's time?
Well, it's not one of the goals of the course. When I introduced the course, we certainly made those connections. with, you know, what exactly is slavery? How long has slavery been a part of the human experience, which is essentially forever? Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid it always will be. And we compared the institutionalized slavery of the United States between 1620 and 1865 and the kind of slavery that goes on today in, say, India with bonded labor or sex trafficking and those sorts of things. And I think that was an important connection in terms of laying a foundation for the course.
I'm wondering if other colleges are studying this field of research, too. Are you making connections with other professors?
I have been told by my colleagues at the seminar and by other friends that there aren't very many. And then my own research tells me that there aren't many. You can go several pages into a basic Google search and not find many. So I don't think there are too many like it. There are a few, of course, but not too many. And so I'm really happy that I can offer it at a school the size of our school. Typically, you'll find it at, if you find it, it's going to be at large research institutions.
So some innovation happening right at the University of Sioux Falls. What's next for you in your research on this topic, Kevin?
Well, I need to finish this article on Shadow and Sunshine, which was the slave narrative published in Omaha in 1906. And from there, I'm not sure. I will dive into the archive and look for something that interests me. I might go with a theme. I might go with another regional concern. I'm not quite sure yet.
Kevin Cole is a professor of English at the University of Sioux Falls. Kevin, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Lori.
When we come back, SDPB's Jennifer Jones tells us her story of a month of volunteering at a refugee camp in Greece. You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.